Lengua sin manos, cómo osas hablar? Tongue without hands, how dare you speak? Here in this house, in the dining room, there was a big, which is a big room, there was a big carpet, kind of Persian-y carpet, with quite broad borders around it, with square. And I was a rather solitary child, not lonely, but I never wanted friends until about 15. And I had two great amusements, above all, well, reading especially, of course. But apart from that, in good weather, I would go out to the back garden and I would play tennis up against the, just by myself, up against the wall of the shed at the bottom of the back garden. And I replayed Wimbledon. And I managed to get all the people that hadn't won and that I would have wanted to win, they all won in my Wimbledon. And indoors, on the carpet in the dining room, I had a lot of dinky cars, you know, models of, they would fit in a hand, you know, in your hand. Beautiful models of racing cars of those days. And I was mad about motor racing. I mean, the racing cars then were very beautiful. The Maseratis, the Bugattis, the Alfa Romeos, the Mercedes-Benzes, the Auto Unions. They were very beautiful cars and various colours. And so I re-performed those races around the border of the carpet. And I remember one day when I was 15, having been called in for tea to the kitchen, and having put put the cars away into their boxes, I remember standing in the middle of the carpet there, looking down at it, and suddenly realizing, I've got to stop being a child. From now on, I cannot be a child anymore. I have stopped. I am stopping childhood. And I remember feeling, just for a minute or two maybe, a sense of desolation, utter desolation and loss, and wanting to go back to childhood, and knowing at the same time, this is one of the clearest memories I have ever, knowing at the same time that it was quite impossible. And now whether that moment happened before or after, I'm not sure, but it couldn't have been long before or long after I had the first wet dream. And of course that is something that changes everybody's life, with all the possible consequences. And that was the beginning then. And I also took to the booze when I could, when I was 16 and especially 17. And that was the beginning of my long argy-bargy with my mother, who thought neither sex nor booze should ever have been invented. My mother and father met in Sinn Féin in Glasgow. But he lost his job because he wouldn't give up his Sinn Féin activities. He started out as an apprentice printer at 14, and he was the first Catholic and the first Irish person to be employed in a big printing firm called Miller's. And my father gradually achieved the position of managing director of that firm. But one day, old Mr. Miller, as he always called him, brought him into his office and said that he'd been told by the police to ask my father to resign. He said he didn't want him to go, but they were, to resign if he wouldn't give up his Sinn Féin activities. So my father said, "I won't do either." So he got the sack, and he was deported to Frongoch, which was a great internment camp, you know, for a lot of Irish people at that time. And then later imprisoned in Mountjoy because he took the anti-treaty side. And so he found it hard to get work in Dublin, in Ireland. He was born in Seville Place, in the North Strand. So he was a Dublin man. So they had to go back to Scotland, and where I was born in 1927. But then when De Valera got into power, my mother wrote a letter to De Valera, whom she knew to some extent. She was a good friend of Countess Markovitch, but she had met De Valera a few times, and she wrote saying, look, we have made a sacrifice for Ireland. I want to bring my son up in Holy Catholic Ireland. The fact that it was De Valera was in power and they'd been on his side in the Civil War, that consoled them greatly. But, you see, my mother was a very intelligent woman, but she was also a Puritan. She'd been brought up as a Puritan. My father, I don't think, would ever have gone set foot in a church if she hadn't badgered him into it. And he was a socialist as well as a nationalist. And when De Valera began to execute Republicans, she was deeply depressed and disillusioned. And she never forgave De Valera for that. I think his time in internment in Wales and in Mountjoy, where he was beaten up in the dungeons, I think, you see, he was in his 50s by the time I was born, and not having had this well-paid job and then not being able to get work and having to live off my mother's earnings as a teacher and a lodging housekeeper, both in Greenock and here in Dublin, I think it kind of broke him a bit. It broke his spirit. For most of my life, while they were both alive, they had rows. They had frequent rows. And I remember my mother once actually seeing her in the kitchen. She was at one end of the kitchen. My father was going out the door of the kitchen, and it had a terrible argy-bargy. And she actually threw a hammer at him, which missed. Now, that's the only time I remember anything like that. But she early on, I think, not long after I was born, stopped having sex with him. Though he never stopped being in love with her right up to the end. But he was several years older than her. And I think he was a great gardener, and I think his garden was his great solace. And me, I mean, I was an only child, and they both pampered me like mad. We lived, to begin with, in Moyne Road in Ranelagh, with a very prissy, respectable landlady called Miss Brown. We just had one rented room, I think, in use of the kitchen. And Miss Brown and my mother were at loggerheads because Miss Brown was Fine Gael, and rabid Fine Gael, and my mother was rabid Republican. So they used to have terrible disagreements. And I went to school in Ranelagh to the Mrs. Cassidy. I remember the silver railings. They had a small school, small private school. That's where I first learned Irish, of course. And then we lived in Fitzwilliam Square, Fitzwilliam Street for a while, and then in Grosvenor Terrace, which is just off Leinster Road. And then when I was 10, we moved to the house I still live in Rathgar Road. They're at mind's end, I'm happy to say. I remember when I was coming home from school on the bus from Sing Street, when we turned the corner, when the bus turned the corner into Rathgow Road, some of the, now I'm talking about the 30s and 40s, some of the conductors used to put on a posh accent and call out, Rathgow Road. And, you know, the reason we moved here was to my mother a bigger place so that my mother could keep more lodgers and keep food in our mouths. You know, she was a lodging house keeper. I knew what we weren't posh, you know. I resented those conductors, you know.
And she put a name on them.
A man is screaming in his bathroom and the neighbours mistake it for singing. The door is locked, the windows barred, but the noise goes through the walls and the neighbours mistake it for singing. One says, he hasn't a note in his head. Another, he sounds happy, the monster. And a foreigner strolling in the street below marvels, what exuberance, what brio these people have. What noise can the man himself think he is making? Then I went abroad to Geneva for 2 years and worked as a translator for the United Nations, the International Labour Office. And then I went to Spain via Portugal. And the one thing I got out of the year and a half in UCD was, well, apart from falling in love for the first time, having been in lust for several years, but never love, and that, again, is a sea change. Apart from that, the main thing I got out of it was that I learnt Spanish and fell in love with it, and therefore Spain, and decided that's where I wanted to live. Sometime in 1963, I was 37 then, and I found myself going on the spree all day in all over Barcelona with two young Irish brothers who were teaching English in Barcelona. And we ended up at about 2 in the morning, perhaps, in a bar called the Bar Brandy in a small side street off the Paralelo, which is kind of semi red light district. And they lived quite near there, and I was going to stay the night with them. And there was a small bar with about 3 people who turned out to be regulars sitting on stools. There were no tables at the bar. And there was a woman, the woman of the house, Banaliana, striding up and down behind the counter in jodhpurs, cracking a whip. A formidable creature she was. And we ordered 3 vermouth, and she charged us 3 times the normal price, which was a bit much, and we protested. Now, none of us were sober, but we were perfectly within our rights to protest. And all hell broke loose. And the next thing, the regulars were lifting stools and attacking us, and I was pushed out through the glass door, glass splintering all around. I didn't get cut, oddly enough, and then we took to our heels, and we had only just got to bed in their small flat when the door was broken down. It was 5 stories up, and the door was broken down by the police, whom the Bar Brandy jodhpur lassie had called, obviously, and we were beaten down the stairs, beaten with batons on the backs of our legs, and down the stairs into a police car. And in the police car, one of us, who didn't know very much Spanish, expressed his opinion of Franco in two words, one of which was Franco's name, and the other in front of it was a good old Anglo-Saxon monosyllable, whereupon they slapped him across the face, you know, side to side. And so we were charged with being drunk and disorderly, but the much more serious accusation was hacer mofa del jefe del Estado, mocking the chief of state, namely Francisco Franco y Bahamonde, the generalissimo. And we were in a big cell in the Palace of Justice with four or five Spanish, mostly Andalusian, petty crooks of one kind or another. One old man, he was the only old man there, and I don't know, maybe he was embittered by something. Old men tend to get embittered at times. But he said to me, I had a beard, you see. It was brown at that time. And he said to me, you know, you'll get jailed for this. You'll get years in jail. And the first thing they'll do to you when they get you into jail is they'll shave that beard off. And I can tell you, the prison barbers are not gentle. And you know, that upset me more than anything else. The prospect of it. But at a certain point, at about 1 a.m, three of us were brought into the chief judge's palatial office. Oh, I had spoken earlier in an open plan office to one of the judges. There were about 10 judges interviewing the people at different tables and they were all talking Catalan to each other, shouting across at each other in Catalan. And he grilled me for a while, and then he asked me what I was doing there, and I said teaching English, and I thought I had to say this to kind of try and preserve. I was scared out of my wits, of course, but to kind of try and preserve some shred of dignity or self-respect, whatever you call it, I said, and I've also been translating and plan to go on translating quite a lot of Catalan poetry into English and Irish. But anyway, after a while, he thought and he said, well, I think that you are, the case against you is not as serious as against your friends. I think you could get out shortly, but I'm afraid they may not. And then he summoned a guard to take me back to the cell, and it was about 2 minutes' walk back to the cell, and in those 2 minutes I had to think furiously, what am I going to tell them, because I couldn't possibly tell them that. But anyway, at about 1 a.m, we were brought into the big judge's office, thick pile carpet, and he was standing in a most immaculate suit behind his huge desk, and anyway, he told us that the charges he had decided were not as serious as he had thought, and to come back in a fortnight's time for our acquittal papers. And he warned me, he said, let this be a lesson to you, what is, you know, associating with younger people lead you astray. Thank you. So we left. It was, I don't know what time in the morning it was, small hours. And we walked, quite a long walk, back to their place where I was again staying the night. And there was one bar open, and we went into it. We were the only customers. We had three brandies. We sat at the bar, and the rather sleepy barman, and we had agreed before we got to the bar that we would never again tell or listen to a Franco joke. And after we had taken a couple of sips, the barman said to us, "Listen, did you hear the latest Franco joke?" And what could we do? And we couldn't possibly say no. So, started all over again. But I stayed on, and about 2 months later, I went to the police to get my residence permit renewed. Oh, and by that time I had got my acquittal, which was a provisional acquittal. And I didn't care for the word provisional, but it was better than nothing. But then I went to the police. They told me to come back the next week, and then the week after that. And the third time I went back, they told me that they could not renew my residence permit, that they could give me an 8-day exit permit. And I said, "But I don't want to go, I want to stay." And they said, "Well, if you prefer..." No, they said, through the hatch, they said, "We're offering you an 8-day permit, exit permit, that's all." So I asked to see the chief of police. A very suave man. He didn't ask me to sit down, mind you. And I showed him my paper, the provisional acquittal. He looked at it and then he said, "Listen, Senor Hutchinson," if we were speaking Castilian, of course. He was Castilian, not Catalan. And he threw it back across the table at me and said, "You would agree, wouldn't you, that if the police in your country want a foreigner to leave, they would tell him to leave?" And, well, I can't remember what I said, but I pleaded with him. Not abjectly, but I said, "Look, I want to stay. I love Spain. I love Barcelona." And he said, "Well, you know, if you don't want to take the 8-day exit permit, we can always deport you in 24 hours. So I asked, could I ring the embassy in Madrid? He said, "No." And so I thought I'd better accept the 8-day exit permit. And I left. And but I talked to some Catalan friends, and they suggested that I go out to Perpignan, which is more than it was then. It's now more than it was then. It was a Catalan city always, in what is called French Catalonia, and somebody gave me the address of a Catalan exile living in Perpignan. So I got the bus and went there, and he brought me to see, he said, "Keralt is the man for you." So he brought me to see this man called Josep Keralt y Clapas, one of the finest men I've ever known in my life. He was then about 50. He had been a publisher, Catalan publisher in Barcelona, under the Republic and the Generalitat, and I'd had to go into exile, of course, but I'd carried on the publishing in Perpignan. And I remember the other man brought me out to see him in, he was sitting in his back garden, a small, stocky man with a big Mediterranean jowl, and in shorts. It was a hot summer day, and he jumped up from his seat and embraced me and he cried out, "Un Irlandés que parla català," an Irishman who speaks Catalan. And he embraced me like a bear hug. And I stayed with him and his wife, who was from the Pyrenees, for a fortnight. And then finally, he had a friend at the border who found out that I was not on a blacklist. And so I could go back just as a tourist. So for the next 3 years, I went on living in Barcelona. I came back in 67. I went out every 3 months or so and stayed with him. And he told me, and came back as a tourist. And a girl in Jerez de la Frontera in the autumn of 1952. Lank, brownish hair, and from under a pale grey shift, only a faint breast sign. Her bare limbs, thin, limp, and the oldest face I ever saw, the most hopeless, scored by misery, no gleam at all in her eyes. Standing in the barber shop doorway as I was leaving, she asked me if I wanted her. I asked how much. Un duro, a 5 peseta coin. The rate was 1.60 to the pound. I asked her age, 11. And looking down at her, I believed it. Poverty, like love, works wonders. Impeccably Andalusianly shaven, I gave her some money. Can't remember exactly, but not much more than a duro, and made for the nearest bar. Duro is slang for a coin. In the dictionary, duro means hard. Oh, God, so many things. The red earth in the olive groves in Andalusia. The great warmth and friendliness of the people all over Spain, and Portugal indeed. The flamenco singing, the sardanas, the dancing of the sardanas in Barcelona. And this was one of the things that, like the anti-Franco jokes, kept the Catalans going, especially. The sardana is a kind of round dance. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but where 3 or 4 people form a circle, and then the circle, others join it, and it enlarges to 7 or 8 or maybe 10 people all of all ages dancing in a circle, and they put their handbags and jackets and belongings down in a pile in the middle of the circle, and they dance round, and the band, which is called a cobla, plays the sardana. And the sardana came to be the symbol of Catalan. It was the only public assertion of Catalan identity and separateness all through Franco's regime. And it was allowed. They had to allow it, you know? And it was to watch that, a whole square, for example, the Plaza de San Jaume, filled with these people of all ages and all classes dancing. And it's a most wonderful dance. And it has, you know, it's fast, and then it goes slow, almost marking time. And the magnificent sound of the tenora, which is a high kind of whistle, tin whistle kind of instrument. That, to look down at it from a balcony, as I did a few times when I was living on the square, was one of the most wonderful things. I've ever seen. I'm told that the young people now are not interested in the Sardana, which is a great shame. But then...
That's freedom for you.
That's freedom, yes. That's freedom of a sort, yeah. An old watchmaker in Barcelona in the early 60s, he said to me one day, he said, Spain is a glory even now, as long as you never have anything to do with the police. And he was right, you know. And another man, an old Republican, said to me in Valencia in the mid-50s, in a bar called the Half Moon in Valencia. I was there with John Jordan and another friend. And he said to me, España, antes era una gloria. Spain, before, was a glory. And by before, he meant before Franco, you know. And he was more or less drinking himself to perdition. And Spain, you know, even under Franco, it could be a wonderful country, you know. But, well... And then I was offered a job in Leeds. And it was there, for example, that I first met Darragh O'Cahan, the great Shannon singer, and who had been working on the sites, was working on them. And we met in the, with a couple of Irish people, in the Irish Centre in Leeds, one quiet afternoon. We'd been turfed out of whatever pub we'd been drinking in. We spoke Irish to Darragh, and we asked him to sing. And he said he hadn't sung for about 13 years because there was no audience. But he was loath to sing, but he finally did, and he went on singing. And it was a voice full of the warmth and the love for human beings that when you were in his company, he just flowed out of him. And he managed to put that all into his singing. And the pain, I suppose. He said to me, "Ta hit me in raw, nor a vime on og." I fell in love when I was very young. He was a lover, and the love came through in the singing, and the love, not just of individuals, but. No, I did like Leeds, actually. I quite like Leeds. And I made several very good friends there. I never found a pub that I was really would call a local in Leeds. I didn't care for the pubs, especially the public bars. As I had a beard and glasses, I was working at the university, and I was frozen out of a couple of public bars, you know, in Leeds. The class distinction there cuts both ways, and it's so much stronger than here. I mean, it was, well, I'm talking about the 70s now. but it was very strong. I was even told in one pub, which was the nearest one to where I was living, oh, we don't want people like you here. So I got the message. I could borrow 25 books at a time, if I could have carried them, from the university library. I had an account in the university bookshop. I could afford to buy books for the first time in years. And for the when I came back, I couldn't for a long time either. I had a very pleasant flat. With a red telephone beside the bed, I may say. And, you know, for about 2 years, and I had some very good students, and there was a great film club in Leeds, and a very good theatre, and there was the largest Jewish population in England outside London, and a very large West Indian population too, which meant that there was wonderful food, delicatessens, and one of the most continental market I've ever been in, apart from the actual continent. But more of my colleagues in the university tried to tell me Irish, so-called Irish jokes, than in any of the pubs, with any of the ordinary people I met. And so I just finally, I mean, I didn't listen from the start. I said, I don't want to hear it. And which meant that budding friendships were quickly abolished, you know. But then, I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to be. I found that illuminating, mind you, that it was the supposedly educated classes who were more given to it. Though, mind you, I will say that most of them were from the south of England, and some of them were eating their hearts out because they weren't in Oxford or Cambridge, you know. They felt they were as much in exile, more in exile, in fact, than I was. I was in Leeds on Bloody Sunday. The following Saturday, there was a big demonstration in Leeds organised by the various Irish groups and by the trade unions. We walked through the centre of Leeds and... But I remember we were passing a pub called the Horse and Trumpet, which I rather liked. I mean, the march or the demo was passing the pub called the Horse and Trumpet, that had about the best steak and kidney pie in Leeds and the best cottage pie, and I loved both. I used to go into it. But as we were passing, it was just the beginning of the Holy Hours, and there was a group of about six men standing outside it. They'd just come out of the pub, and they started shouting at us, "Go home, you Fenian gets." And somebody I was walking with told me that was the Orange Pub in Leeds, which I hadn't known. So I had to give up my lovely cottage pie. I didn't want to go in there anymore.
And in terms of your writing, at the very least, politics have always been very central to it, haven't they?
The frost is all over. Oh, yes. The title poem itself actually gives many of the themes and of your book. Could you read it?
Okay. Frost is all over for Michael Hartnett. To kill a language is to kill a people. The Aztecs knew far better. They took over their victims' language, kept them carving obsidian beauties, weeded their religion of dangerous gentleness, and winged them blood flowers. That's a different way to kill a people. The Normans brought and grew, but Honor Croom could never make her Kerryman verse English. Traherne was in the music of his tears. We have no glint or caution who we are. Our patriots dream wolfhounds in their portraits. Our vendors pose in hunting garb.
the nightmare forelock tugging madly at some lost leash.
Spain, the Vikings never I think, xenophilia means bland made me we insult ourselves and irreversibly political. I mean, you couldn't... And knowing people like the old Republicans that I knew in Geneva and then in Perpignan, and knowing what had been done to them, and seeing the horrors of fascism, well, you couldn't but be political, you know. And that carried over then into anywhere in the world. But the trouble is, the first book I published was called, the first book of my own poems was called Tongue Without Hands, which is taken from a line in the Spanish epic poem, the Poema del Cid, about the great Cid Campeador who conquered the Moors. It's largely rather boring, like most epics, but there's a line which struck home to me very painfully. Lengua sin manos, quemo osas fablar, tongue without hands, how dare you speak? And it is uttered by a warrior in a council of war to the poet. The poet's expected to sing the praises of the champion, you know, the warriors. And the poet dares to voice an opinion. And the warrior says, tongue without hands, how dare you speak? And that is a dilemma of many poets. Thank you.